This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, and get the one talk, Manuel Itzayao, and good fellow morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We're proud to say that Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Well, we'll have live updates from Solomon Islands as we get closer to that election day. And also, will Ea Vanuatu go into liquidation? We'll check that out. And it's Cook Islands Pride Week, a year on when the island nation decriminalised same-sex relations. More on those stories shortly. And remember, our stories will go up online once our show is finished. And if you want to find them, simply type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. And if you haven't checked out our Facebook and Instagram page, head to ABC Pacific, like and follow. We appreciate your feedback also, just to make sure we really are on the right track. I'm Aggie Thabol, and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Wow, we've got a big show today, but first we're heading over to the Solomon Islands, where it's been a busy and at times noisy weekend in the capital Honiara ahead of this week's national election. Well, that is some sounds and colour from the streets of Honiara as candidates head into the final days of campaigning in what's the largest election in Solomon Islands history. So joining us this morning from Honiara is Pacific Beat producer Evan Wasuka. Evan, look, welcome to the show, but firstly, you know, we're used to having you here in the studio in Melbourne, but for this week you're on the ground in Honiara. And I would like for you firstly to bring us up to speed. Let's go back a little bit to last weekend. What has been sort of the build-up towards this week's elections?
Hey, morning, Aggie. Yeah, so it's the final week as we head into the national elections, which is happening on Wednesday. Yeah, as you heard, we've had a bit of noise, a bit of colour here in the capital, Honiara. So there's been lots of these vehicle parades happening all across the street. So candidates have been coming through with dozens of vehicles, lots of shouting. But apart from that, it's pretty quiet here in Honiara. But the thing on everyone's mind right now is the elections. As soon as I arrived at the airport, the conversations have just all been about politics and what's coming up in the elections. The other thing is it's a lot quieter now because a lot of people have left the capital Honiara. They've gone out to vote in the provinces, which means lots of traveling, and the ships and the wharves have been really full with people heading out. One of the first things I did when I arrived on Friday was we headed off to the wharf with Christian Rita Armando Leong, our reporter here in Honiara. She did some filming, and I managed to talk to some people about why they were leaving the capital ahead of the elections and why it was important for them to go back to their villages to cast their votes. These were some of the things they had said at the wharf.
Why I need to go home to vote is that for us at home, we really need change. Actually, we're stranded here in Honiara, but we're struggling to travel and head back to change our MP back in the province. We need change because at the moment, none of our leaders listens to us. The young people can't find jobs. We don't have access to those in government. We want to try and put our vote behind anyone who will listen to us. We want to put them into parliament. I stay in Honiara, but I vote in Malaita. I registered in Malaita because that is where I'm from. I'm only here in Honiara because of work. So when I want to vote for my parliamentarian, I'll go back to my homeland. I just want to tell the people, those of us who are struggling to get to home to vote, please vote wisely and choose your good leader.
I'm Catherine Kabolo.
I'm voting in Western Province in Gizo, Kolombangara. The MP I choose will be someone who is thinking of the country and trying his best to develop it. I didn't vote at the last election. This will be my first election. I'm kind of excited about voting in this election. We have to choose someone who can help the country and help people, and someone who can think ahead and help develop our nation.
For looking development for country and also too.
I'm voting in the Western Province, in the constituency of Gizo Kolombangara. I chose to vote there because that is my home. It's where I'm from. I stay in Honiara, but I choose to vote in the Western province. When I vote, I want my MP to be a good leader and have good leadership skills to develop the constituency.
Helping my people and helping our country as well, nation.
Yeah, so those are just some of the people we spoke to at the Wharf, which is kind of the place to be at the weekend. It's really crowded, lots of people jumping on ships, trying to get on ships to get back home for the last couple of days before the nation goes to the ballots. So not a lot of time left, Aggie, before the we get to Election Day.
Yeah, Evan, I know a lot of action is happening outside of Honiara, but what is actually happening there in the capital itself of Honiara?
Yeah, so Aggie, like I was saying, while the capital is a bit emptier, Honiara does have the largest constituencies in the country. We've got the Central Honiara constituency, the East Honiara. These are two among the biggest in the country. There's also West Honiara. The thing with Honiara is that it can be unpredictable because we have lots of mixed communities here. There's no like one dominant language grouping amongst the community. So we'll see what comes out of the elections in Central Honiara. We've had a new sort of the current MP has only been there for one term, but in East Honiara the member Douglas Etta, he's been there for about three terms, and he's a strong opposition figure. In West Honiara, which is a smaller constituency, Namson Tram is the member for this constituency. He's been there for the past three terms. So it's unpredictable how things will go here in Honiara, but lots of campaigning over the weekend. But these three are the ones who are standing strong within the capital.
Mm. And with the time that you've been there, apart from the incumbents, is there any candidates that have captured your attention?
Well, Aggie, with Solomon Islands politics, there's lots of different characters we've had over the years. And look, in this election, there's about five former prime ministers who are standing for parliament who want to come back and be at the leadership of the country. One of them is contesting the Central Honiara constituency. His name is Gordon Dasilillo. He's a former prime minister. Over here, he's known as GDL. He hasn't won here in Honiara before, and he wasn't in the parliament in the last term. He's been doing a lot of campaigning in the capital. And yesterday, I managed to catch up with him while he was in Kwa Hill, which is an informal settlement on the back of Honiara. Here's a bit of his campaign, which he had yesterday, and the conversation I had with him while I was up there.
Our incoming candidate for this upcoming national election, he's at my back. Let's give him a hand. Another hand. And another one. Brother Gordon, on behalf of the leaders for here again, me as the chairperson of this place, me warmly welcome you.
Well, I felt that, you know, the economy of this country has been badly mismanaged. We can actually see the implication of that bad management on the economy, public finance, which is in a small island state like economy like Solomon Islands. Public finance or fiscal policy is a very key factor in ensuring that, you know, you have a well-guided and also well-focused management of the economy. We haven't seen that over the last 8 or 9 years. And you can actually see the situation on the ground, a crippling health system, under-resourced education sector, same with law and order situation as well.
Before we go further into national politics, previously you stood in Gizo Kolombangara, now you're running in Central Honiara. Why are you coming and standing up here in the capital?
Well, it's a very fantastic constituency. And as you know, constituencies throughout the country is basically a platform for us to elect elected representatives. But the most important thing about Central Honiara is that it is right in the center of the country. It is kind of a region or a constituency that is very much the heartbeat of the country. You have all the main state institutions that are located in this constituency. But that aside, you know, I mean, these are constituencies that, you know, everybody has the constitutional rights to make a choice And if you are given the opportunity, you know, to be considered as a candidate, you know, to take up the responsibility at the national level, I think it's just a fantastic thing to do, to have.
Now, you touched on geopolitics there. You mentioned it. What's your position on this? Are you supportive of that switch away from Taiwan to China, or how do you see the future?
Look, you know, the great power contestation is that has to be the starting point in the whole debate, because the whole world will still in a way, you know, be watching how the great power contestation is being played out by all the great powers. I think that's the most important thing that, you know, we need to put to people, rather than picking a particular choice that is made on whether or not you choose to switch from a particular choice to the other choice. If I were going to be asked about this whole thing, you know, I would say that, you know, what we need to do is to behave more responsibly and in a more transparent way.
Just in summary, would you support the current situation right now in terms of foreign affairs, or would you be looking to change away from the relations with Beijing?
I would urge that, you know, we need a more friendly great powers. You know, I want to urge China and USA to resolve their differences. I want them to better communicate, because if they communicate well, we will have a better world for all of us. And we can, in some ways, you know, find a way for the least developed countries like Solomon Islands to slowly, you know, find a platform, you know, to advance. You know, we are struggling, but we need the whole international economic system to work.
And that was a former Prime Minister, Finance Minister and former MP Gordon Darcy-Lilo. Evan, you know, Solomon Islanders, like most Pacific countries, are actually staunch Christians. So I'm wondering, what was Sunday like in the capital? Were there any sort of special messages from the churches?
Well, definitely, Aggie. Yep, Sunday is a day of church, and we had candidates visiting the different churches around the capital yesterday as well. So definitely the church and politics, there is a link between the two. And because churches are so dominant here, people do turn to church leaders to talk about politics and for guidance and things like that. So yesterday, Chris and Rita, Armando Leong, a reporter here in the capital, and I, we attended Mass at the Holy Cross Cathedral right here in the heart of Honiara. Let's have a listen to what came up in church yesterday.
But inside the election process, we do not need any con men or con women. We need men and women who promote peace, love, truth, and justice.
That was, Aggie, that was Archbishop Christopher Cardone. He is the head of the Catholic Church here in the Solomons, and he's also a key member of the Solomon Islands Christian Association. So he used his Mass yesterday, which had around several thousand people attending, to talk about upcoming elections and making that decision when you cast your ballot. I managed to catch up with him after the service, and we had a little bit of chat, and I managed to get some more of his thoughts around the coming elections.
Nice.
ABC has a great concern for the Solomon Islands and the election process. As you heard from my homily today at our very large and well-attended 9 o'clock Mass, we're trying to educate the people to make good and informed choices. I often say that we have leaders who are not so virtuous, not so humble, and not so hardworking. So I gave the example at Mass. When I often meet the youth, I ask them if they are good men or con men, or if it's a woman, good man or a con woman. And I asked a young fellow who is half Malaita and half Guadalcanal, are you a good man or a con man? And he said, oh, I only con a little bit. So I made that story, and people often laugh, because often we have leaders that are not really concerned with the common good, and many of our leaders are concerned with their own well-being first and then the community. When I was a parish priest in Gizo in the 1990s, a man from the Shortlands told me that the motto of the Solomon Islanders for the parliament members should be, to lead is to serve yourself first. And I thought that was being very judgmental against our national leaders. But if you study the actions and the record of some of our parliament members, some of them serve themselves first and not the community.
You've been around a long time in the Solomon Islands. What's so special about this election, and why do you think it's so important for people in the country to choose wisely?
I've been here for 34 years, so I've been here for most of the existence of the Solomon Islands. And I always say that it's a relatively small country with very, very good resources, both human resources and natural resources. So we should be a pretty prosperous and a pretty developed place. But because of the fact that we don't always have unity and we don't always have good leaders, I feel that the country is really slacking in the area of development and prosperity for all the people. So over the last 34 years that I've been here, I've been witness to the various ethnic conflicts that we've had, and we're hoping that this election we can change from being a community that is fairly hopeless to being a hopeful community where the goods of this nation and the resources can help develop all people.
Archbishop, there's a military contingent here from New Zealand, Australia, and other countries, and you were calling for a peaceful election. How do you see things are right now?
I would say that from my perception here in town and visiting in places around the Archdiocese, that people do not really want tension or violence again. It really disturbed the lives of many, many people, and it really disturbs the name of the Solomon Islands. So I think people really want a peaceful election, and people want also want some change. So we hope that we can continue to have peace both in the election time, and then the challenging time then is the formation of the government, which is about, you know, 1 to 2 weeks later.
And just finally, how do you see the role of the church in terms of politics and election time? How do you see the church? What do you think is important for the church to be doing?
It really is important for the church leaders of all the different denominations and faith communities to try to promote peaceful elections. And I always say that Christians should be both peacemakers and peace builders. So I think all of the churches are trying to highlight that message. And if there is conflict, hopefully people will listen to the church leaders, as they have in the past. No, we're just very grateful to Australia, New Zealand, Fiji, Papua New Guinea, and even China, who have sent fairly large contingents to oversee the elections. And yesterday, I met some people from East Timor who are coming as election observers. So we have many hundreds of people here to help us, and it's good that the country is encouraged that many people are watching the Solomon Islands. And sometimes if we know that we are being watched from heaven above and from many other countries, hopefully it will encourage people to be to have elections that are free and fair. And we hope and pray that good, virtuous people are elected into office.
And that was Solomon Islands Catholic Archbishop Christopher Cardoni. Evan, you know, as he spoke about the influence there of military in the Solomon Islands, yourself, you're there on the ground. What is the actual atmosphere feeling like? Are people feeling safe and at peace with the extra influence of military?
Yeah, look, I've been seeing military personnel about. There was some in church yesterday with us, and they were mixing around, talking with people. This is the Australian and New Zealand military. And people are really happy to see them and introduce themselves. I've also been seeing them around the hotels and the cafe and the eating places as well. But it's all pretty quiet and calm right now, so I'm sure people are happy that there's more military and security on the streets. But things are looking pretty good right now as they are. And as the Archbishop was saying, usually the elections work really well. They're one of the few things that run properly here in Solomon Islands in terms of major events. It's the period after when we have the election for the Prime Minister. Things can get a bit... there can be problems, which has happened in the past. But so far, the streets are calm, everyone's quiet. It looks to be quite safe right now. And it's... So I hope that answers your question, Haggy.
Absolutely. And look, thank you very much, Evan Tagetumas, for just keeping us up to date with the latest on the elections that are about to happen very soon. Come Wednesday, correct me if I'm wrong, there in Solomon Islands. But to those who are tuning in, remember Wednesday is when Solomon Islanders will head to the polls to elect their 52 MPs. You can catch all the latest here on Pacific Beat. But again, thank you very much, Evan, for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Aggie.
Hi, I'm Sayuli Salama Sinovan Raiki, and I invite you to come with me to explore how our Pacific cultures have evolved with the changing times in a new show, Culture Compass. You'll meet people who are passionate about keeping traditions alive, passing them down to the next generation while adapting old ways to the present. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Thabol. Well, half a litre per person per day? That's how much water people in parts of the Federated States of Micronesia have to survive on amid an extreme drought. Yap State is one of the areas hardest hit. It has some water reservoirs, but outer islands rely solely on rainwater and supplies are dwindling. The government and aid agencies have been delivering water to the affected areas, but locals say they need more help, as Dubrovka Volodya reports.
Many residents in Yap State's outer islands have had to ration their drinking water for months.
The grass is crispy, they said. They are now down to about a few more days of water on one island, Falalop.
John Rumal is a community leader from Falalop Island on Ulithi Atoll, who's currently in Guam to organize more aid for his community.
It's alarming or disturbing or scary to me because Falalop being the larger one with a little bit more excess, you know, having the high school and the air terminal there. So if they're reporting that they're down to that much, then the rest of the more remote outer island within just the atoll is probably in dire need right now.
He says the last water delivery to his community was too small. The last drop was 360 liters for his community of 350 people.
They're getting creative on rationing from what I can hear. It's alarming. It's a little disturbing. Scary.
Mr. Rumal says it's unclear when the next water delivery will be. He says the water distribution is not always working, with some smaller islands receiving even less. He's concerned about the most vulnerable in his community.
The grandmothers who will not drink because there's very little water and it's going to go to their grandchild. Those are the members that I'm nervous about now. Elders and chiefs will start to prioritize their vulnerable members of their communities. And that's scary to me because they won't say anything. It's not cultural. We don't complain about food.
Water is being delivered in small plastic bottles, which will cause issues with rubbish disposal in the longer term. Mr. Rumal says it would be better if it came in large tanks, along with reverse osmosis machines. The area is in a state of emergency. Meanwhile, UNICEF's water specialist for the Northern Pacific, Jeffrey Ng, says the situation is critical in parts of Yap.
Now almost 90% of their rainwater tanks are empty, and the government has sent some water to the island to help the people in the outer island. But now the situation is getting worse once they reach the extreme. So even in the main island, people on the main island already start having problem to have access to water.
He says officials have been distributing water, but it might not be enough in some areas.
The last distribution, the government has provided like half a liter per person per day. that is going to last them for 3 to 4 months. Of course, we all aware of that this number is still not sufficient because definitely people will need more than that.
Mr. Ng says UNICEF is planning to send some large water containers from Fiji. The U.S. Coast Guard is also sending help from Guam. While that is being managed, some residents have had to deal with diarrhea from drinking contaminated water. Others report respiratory issues. Mr. Rulmal says potential food shortages are also a worry, with trees and food gardens getting drier by the day.
Banana is the first one to show signs of lack of water, right? And it's now kind of falling down.
Parts of Marshall Islands are also experiencing extremely dry conditions. Disaster management officials there have delivered drinking water and filters to affected communities. Weather forecaster Landon Adlett says some minor showers might give some relief to affected communities, but it won't be enough to help with the water shortages.
Currently, we are looking at the ongoing drought steadily worsening because we're just not seeing the rainfall across the northern Yap State and the Federated States of Micronesia and the northern Marshall Islands. Yap State, that remains a hot spot with significant drought ongoing.
Fires are also a danger, with a few burning in Yap last week. Parts of Guam are also experiencing dry conditions, and Mr. Adlett, who works with a local weather service, says there's also a fire danger there.
We're still here. We do have days with the red flag warnings, which means that there's extreme fire danger, and that's based on the ongoing dry conditions and the stronger gusty winds.
Palau is also monitoring a dry spell and has called on its people to conserve water. Major rain is forecast, but not until June for the worst affected areas.
And that is Dubravka Volodya reporting.
Pacific Beat.
Vanuatu's Finance Minister, John Salong, has denied social media comments that the national carrier Air Vanuatu, will soon be liquidated. In 2023, Air Vanuatu stopped its Boeing 737 services to Australia and New Zealand due to what the airline said were technical issues. The disruptions to the airline's services remain to impact on much-needed revenue for the government, especially from the tourism sector. Minister Salong told ABC, people should not believe everything they see on social media.
The real story is that we should never believe these people who are rumor mongers in Facebook. There has not been any decision made by either directors or the shareholders, of which I am a shareholder, through the declaration of bankruptcy or even of receivership or voluntary liquidation. That decision has not been made. Air Vanuatu has had challenges for a long time, and those challenges are coming home to roost at this time. So everybody is making it look like it's an emerging issue. It has been an issue for a long time, and the issues are not just particular to Air Vanuatu. The particular issues of airlines after the lockdowns have been across the globe. There have been a lot of airline companies that have gone bankrupt. And so Air Vanuatu is just another airline. It just so happens that it is very important airline for the whole of Vanuatu because he has the spirit of Vanuatu. He has the Vanuatu flag, and it's very important for the tourism sector in Vanuatu. So such rumor mongering doesn't help in generating the kind of spirit that we want to put out in Vanuatu.
Minister, now you've just mentioned tourism in Vanuatu. Now, that has been suffering since Vanuatu started facing problems.
Absolutely. We had an interview probably back in November 2023, if I remember correctly, and we were expressing the same issues of difficulties of scheduling by Vanuatu has a negative impact on tourism in Vanuatu. Wholesalers have difficulty continuing to sell Vanuatu as a destination. And retailers have big challenges trying to put people through because they are never certain of when they can come in and when they can go out. So these are problems for the whole economy of Vanuatu, not just the tourism sector. Even for the seasonal workers program, those who are going to RIC in New Zealand and SWB or PLALM in Australia, they have very huge challenges in trying to get people from Vanuatu to Australia and New Zealand. So we have a huge problem of Vanuatu economy, including tourism, if there is no regular scheduling by Vanuatu.
Is your government doing anything to help in that way? Or?
Okay, so the first issue is we have come in since October of 2023 as a new government, so it's not even been 6 months yet. So the articles of association have been registered with Financial Services Commission for the airline to basically go through and possibly be able to have private shareholders. That's already registered. But you cannot sell a company that has not any clean books. So the books are being processed. At the moment, we need to be able to get to the point where we have a clear idea of non-performing loans that we can put to one side and the assets that are performing, and then we can begin to think about how we restructure the company so that it can begin to look forward towards a new Vanuatu. We have had a new board of directors in Vanuatu since probably January this year. These are private sector people with one director general, and they are trying to get back to the history of bad management, history of bad decisions, trying to get all the documentary processes in place so that decisions can be made based on sound financial and evidence documents. We have dealt with some of the pressing matters in relation to outstanding lease and maintenance reserve funds, which have not been kept up to date. With regard to the important aircraft, the ATR has been dealt with. The Boeing is being dealt with. We also, at the same time, have Boeing in what they call C check right now in Melbourne, which could easily take the whole month of April. And once that C check is done and completed, then the Boeing aircraft will be fully functional again as new. And that's a normal process. And so that's hindering some of the services in terms of flights to Australia, New Zealand, and say Fiji, and New Caledonia.
At the moment, Vanuatu is leasing aircrafts from Solomon Islands and Nauru. What's the deal there?
We also contracted in, of course, what they call wet leases with Air Nauru and Solomon Airlines to backstop. But some of these airlines have also had some challenges. Solomon Airlines has also had some challenges in terms of maintaining the schedules that have been contracted by Air Vanuatu. So this is a complex web of issues that is compounding at this time and makes it look like nobody is doing anything. But a lot of issues are to do with the fact that in the shutdowns, there was a lot of supply chain breakdowns. And so for the C check of the Boeing aircraft in Melbourne, of course, parts have to be flown in from other parts of the world to come and make sure that it's fully serviced and it's fully renovated like a new plane before it can become operational again. In the meantime, if our contracted suppliers are not able to keep up because of technical issues, it's somewhat beyond our control.
The new airline that you're talking about, will it still have Air Vanuatu as a name?
We don't know because that decision is yet to be made once all the decisions are made based on evidence and sound financial documents. The board of directors will consider them and then the shareholders will consider them as per normal. The Council of Ministers will obviously endorse whatever decisions that are made and eventually the decision will be made, but it's yet to be made.
And that's Finance Minister John Sollong there, speaking to ABC's Caroline Turriman. Up next, we've got your news wrap. That is right. It is that time where we head around the region. We get the latest headlines in our news wrap brought to us by our producer, Mackenzie Smith. With that, I say good morning, Mackenzie.
Morning, Aggie.
Great to have you on the show. A senior Fijian military leader has been removed from his post in the Australian Army. What has happened?
Yeah, so this is Colonel Ben Naliva. He was serving as deputy commander of the Australian Army's 7th Brigade. But allegations emerged that he was involved in the torture of the military government's opponents following the coup in Fiji back in 2006. Now, the Republic of Fiji military forces have denied the allegations, while the Australian Army had ordered a review. Now, following that, the Australian newspaper reports that Naliva has been removed from his post and instead sent to the Australian Defence College, where he will contribute to Pacific-related research projects. The Australian Defence Force is also reportedly reviewing the processes of how it embeds Pacific Island commanders in its forces to ensure that this doesn't happen in the future.
Wow. Let's head to the Cook Islands, because there seems to be some concerns, though, about proposed cryptocurrency legislation. Elaborate, please.
Yeah, this is a new law. It's called the Tainted Cryptocurrency Recovery Bill 2023. And according to an investigation by One News, it's drafted by an American debt collecting company, Drumcliff. So the bill is meant to be able to help the government find and seize cryptocurrency assets that are being used for criminal activity. But critics and experts that One News spoke to say it's so broad that it could potentially authorize hacking into government and university systems around the world on the sole basis of suspicion. Those experts are also concerned that a US company had been chosen to write the bill.
Well, obviously I'm wondering, what has the Prime Minister himself, Mark Brown, said?
Well, he didn't respond to One News, but he did put out a press release on Sunday saying the bill will help the fight against international crime and that it would comply with local and international treaties and laws. The bill is currently before Select Committee in Parliament.
Nice. Well, we'll keep our eyes and ears on that story, definitely, Mackenzie, but always great for you to bring us our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
No worries.
No worries. That, again, is our producer, Mackenzie Smith, with the news wrap.
Join Sosse Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubois. This next story, it's all about mosquito-borne viruses. If you don't know dengue fever, it could now be a thing of the past in three major Pacific communities. The same program, which eliminated the virus in Australia's far north Queensland, has successfully been rolled out in Suva, Port Vila and Tarawa. Professor Cam Simmons from Monash University's World Mosquito Program told Kyle Evans he no longer expects it to be a public health problem.
We've been working on bacteria called Wolbachia for many, many years, and some time ago we discovered Wolbachia's fabulous property at stopping mosquitoes from transmitting viruses like dengue and the Zika virus. And our program has been putting that Wolbachia bacteria into mosquito populations in different countries around the world and turning those mosquito populations into what were populations very good at transmitting dengue and turning them into populations of mosquitoes that are no good at transmitting dengue or Zika. And so what our recent work in the Pacific has been showing is that we've been able to successfully deploy Wolbachia into mosquito populations that are responsible for transmitting dengue in Port Vila, in South Tarawa, in Kiribati, in Suva, and Nandi and Lautoka in Fiji. And so our results are showing that Wolbachia has been very successfully established in those populations, and we have every expectation that we will be eliminating dengue as a public health problem in those communities.
Yeah, excellent. So you've targeted those three countries, as you mentioned. How much less of a risk is dengue now in those communities?
Certainly in Vanuatu and Kiribati, no outbreaks since Wolbachia has been established. We continue to work with the Ministry of Health and Medical Services in Fiji to keep tracking the public health outcomes. And so I think we're very happy to say so far so good in the Pacific. And it's really just mirroring results that we've seen elsewhere around the world, including far north Queensland, where this program was implemented in 2011. Dengue has been eliminated from far north Queensland since the program was activated. So we expect our friends in the Pacific to really be joining other communities around the world where dengue's gone as a public health problem because of this program.
Excellent. Now, you mentioned those major centres such as Suva and Port Vila. Do you have a timeline on how long it would take to delete dengue from the countries altogether?
This intervention is probably best suited because it's, an environmental intervention targeted at the mosquito. And it's probably the most cost-effective way is focusing on those cities and those big towns in each country. It may not be a very cost-effective intervention in small villages. And so this is not the only answer to the problem of these diseases that we're talking about, but it's, we think, and many others think, it's an important tool in the toolbox, if you like, to control these diseases. But it's not the only answer.
So, yeah, this program's obviously got some runs on the board, like you mentioned, eradicating dengue in far north Queensland and now the success in these three Pacific countries. What's the plan next? Will you target other areas of the Pacific from here?
Yeah, look, so we're excited at what's happening in New Caledonia. And so New Caledonian government has been working with us for the last 5 years. And we're now at a point in which Noumea has had Wolbachia established right across the residential area of Noumea for the last 2 or 3 years. And that is, the New Caledonian government are really driving a national program with Wolbachia. And so we're delighted to see, you know, four important Pacific countries, you know, have this intervention in their toolbox and, you know, preventing outbreaks. We would welcome other countries who are interested in this approach to public health. But we need donor support to make that happen. Dengue, these diseases, mosquito-borne diseases are neglected and they don't get the sort of funding that you might think they deserve. And so we would welcome interest from other Pacific Island partners, but we need our donor support to make it happen.
And just lastly, are there any specific areas where dengue still is a major problem?
So, you know, dengue rears its head intermittently across the Pacific. That's the history of dengue. And so places like Tonga, Samoa, Cook Islands, recent outbreak a couple of years ago, is quite significant. French Polynesia at the moment. Effectively, all of the Pacific Island countries are at risk of outbreaks. You know, we think this is an important tool in the toolbox, but it sits alongside other existing approaches like mosquito control with insecticides. They're problematic because of resistance in the mosquito populations. They're expensive. You have to use them every year. And so really, everyone's at risk of dengue outbreaks in the Pacific. It's just that some years are quieter than others.
And that was Professor Cam Simmons from Monash University's World Mosquito Program speaking with Carl Evans.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
From one research to another, this is researchers that say they discovered that some colder, deeper layers of coral reefs are currently protected from bleaching, but the effects could get lost if global warming continues. Warmer seas cause problems for the oceans, including coral bleaching, which is badly affecting many reefs, including Australia's Great Barrier Reef. Dr. Jennifer McWhorter from NOAA's Atlantic Oceanographic and Meteorological Laboratory in the US told Dubrovka Volodya, they studied the deeper layers of the Great Barrier Reef, but similar patterns could actually occur on other reefs.
We found that bottom temperatures between 30 and 50 meters can be better off while the surface is warming in certain locations of the Great Barrier Reef, only up until we hit 3 degrees of global average warming. And then those bottom temperatures will also experience warming that could threaten coral reefs.
So that means that if we go to deeper waters, we don't see the bleaching occurring that we see in more shallow water?
That's right. So potentially. So we quantify a stratification metric, kind of like that feeling of when you dive into a body of water and you swim to the bottom and it's cooler on the bottom. It's that same effect. And so we quantified that in a computer simulation. And so there are areas where in the surface is warm, the bottom is still remaining cool, But we lose that reprieve at a certain threshold of global average warming. But yes, steeper reefs can potentially provide a refuge if the water is stratified. And by deeper, I mean we studied from 0 to 50 meters. So the deeper area that I'm talking about is from 30 to 50 meters.
And have those areas not been studied before?
The unique thing that we bring is looking at the climate projections in this level of detail and using this metric as a conceptual tool in an oceanographic setting to give us an idea of spatially and temporally when warming can potentially hit these deeper locations. So previously, climate projections solely used sea surface temperatures. And as we know, corals live on the bottom of the seafloor. So there's only certain areas of the reef where the sea surface temperature is actually a good indication of what's going on down below. And that's in areas where it's fully homogenized or the water column is the same from the top to the bottom. And there are a lot of areas where that's not the case. But the important thing to note is that corals are really sensitive to warming. So we quantify at what point does that warming threaten corals on the bottom of the seafloor.
What does that mean for the Pacific's reefs?
This concept of having deep reef refugia has been circulating around the literature and the research for a while and could provide some silver lining of looking at deeper reefs where there's species that overlap and maybe they're remaining cool while the shallow reefs are bleaching and experiencing mortality. So in one regard, I think it could offer a little bit of hope. But in another regard, it's alarming that we're seeing warming also occur on these reefs under climate change and they lose their status as being a refuge. And we're going to lose that silver lining if we continue putting as much CO2 emissions in the atmosphere as we have been.
And what does it mean for other creatures that live in reefs, such as fish and fish stocks?
That's a great question. So when corals bleach and die, it shifts the community composition of the reef. So the function of the reef changes because the species change. A lot of the function comes from the bouldering, massive corals that build the structure. And I can equate it to the equivalent of having a building or a house that is providing a function for the community. And then when that's destroyed and what comes back is a scaffolding, it doesn't provide as much function, right, as those big structures that help build habitat. In some areas of the Great Barrier Reef, we've seen recovery of these branching corals, which is my analogy to the scaffolding, and they don't provide as much habitat for certain species as these massive bouldering corals would.
And that is Dr. Jennifer McWhorter from NOAA, who led the research during a PhD studentship at the Universities of Exeter and Queensland. It's been published in the journal PNAS Climate Change. And that's the end of our show here on Pacific Beat. Look, we'll be back again same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time. But you can listen in to us this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. Until next time, o doa awhātua, I'm Aggie Tobol here on Pacific Beat.